because Bob Harris had discussed a job with his wife, much less a Nobel Prize. Lord knows what he would do if he knew that Bob Harris had called Nora just the other day, left a long message, this time on their home phone.
I've been meeting with a mess of lawyers, all trying to hike up their billable hours about this foundation thing. I think it would be good for us to talk again real soon so we can nail down your terms and title. Come on now. Let's get this party started.
An eerie pewter light fought its way past the shears into the bedroom, and when Nora went to the bathroom, she could see the snow mounted on the pediment of the house next door. A perfect parabola. Downstairs, Charlie had not started the coffee. Instead, he stood, dripping, in the center of the kitchen, his down jacket on the floor, a pair of old ski pants unsnapped and unzippered at the waist. Nora wondered if this was because he had loosened them or because he hadn't been able to close them at all. He always gained weight over the holidays and when he was unhappy.
No smart-ass comments, all right?
He said, his cheeks red. About what? Said Nora, sliding past him and flinching as a slick of cold water was passed from the waistband of Charlie's pants to the back of her nightgown. It always took her a few beats in the morning to remember what day it was, to make sense of the headlines in the paper. It had been a nightmare when the twins were small and the hour before they left for school had been full of things that needed attention. Permission slips, misplaced homework, snacks that had been promised for a field trip, although not by her. As the coffee maker began to hiss, Nora realized that Charlie had been digging the car out. The parking lot was still closed, the chain across the entrance secured with a new padlock, but George insisted it would reopen any day, and in the meantime, he had persuaded Charlie to join him in parking on the street, as though it would be a defeat to begin to use the enclosed garage again. Charlie was chugging another glass of water, as though he'd been running a marathon. You do understand that you are shoveling snow at 7 a.m. because of George, Nora said.
I'm well aware of your opinion,
Charlie said, wiping his face with a dish towel.
Meanwhile, I've got to get to an off-site in New Jersey.
Seriously? An off-site? One of the things Nora loved about running her own operation was that she never had to authorize a retreat, a team-building day, or an off-site. At her last job, there had been 2 off-sites a year, at which they had heard endless speeches from management gurus, done stress reduction exercises, and attended breakout sessions that consisted of writing your greatest fears on index cards and listening to them being read aloud in an NPR announcer voice by the facilitator. Disappointing others, obviously a woman. Not being promoted, obviously a man. Death. Everyone looked around the circle.
Not ours. The old man thinks they're a waste of time. It's an invitation from...
Here, Charlie mentioned the name of what was obviously a client, with whom she was obviously supposed to be familiar, so Nora nodded and began to make oatmeal. Nodding was good. It was attentive, collegial. Charlie dropped client names as though they were celebrities, although he was unfamiliar with most celebrities, so she supposed it all evened out. The twins had just returned to college after a President's Day break. I want more time off, Rachel had moaned the day they were due to go back to school, standing in the kitchen, eating ice cream from the container.
Me too,
said Oliver, who was dressed almost exactly like his twin sister, something that Nora had vowed, while staring at the sonogram, that she would never do to them herself.
Me three,
Charlie said. There had been a long silence. Nora knew that normally Rachel would have responded with a wisecrack, but she had been noticeably cold to her father since the Ricky incident. If I run into Mr. Fisk, I can't be held responsible for what I might do, Rachel had said at dinner.
I hope you've learned to always be civil to adults, her father said sternly.
Not to adults who attack innocent people, Rachel replied. Charlie blamed Nora for this, too. So it was Oliver who finally said,
Dad, humor. Lame.
Rachel continued to ignore her father and handed her brother the ice cream and the spoon.
There's like 2 spoonfuls left,
Ollie said. And I saved them for you, bro, because I love you.
None for me,
Charlie said, because he could not leave well enough alone. But Rachel just went upstairs.
Women,
Ollie said, ever the peacemaker. The house was now still with that terrible stillness that came after raucous habitation. Nora could only imagine what Rachel's bedroom looked like. There appeared to be a dearth of food in the kitchen, and the cupboards looked as though they had been ransacked. She was sure there had been bags of granola that had found their way into someone's duffel bag. She wondered if there were still raisins. There were still raisins. God bless Charity.
"So I'll probably be late," said Charlie,
and Nora nodded again. Peanut butter and jelly for dinner, her guilty pleasure. She could scarcely wait. She put on her waterproof boots and tucked her indoor shoes into her tote. In an act of insurrection, Nora might wear the boots all day, although she knew Bibi hated them. Bibi never needed to wear boots herself, since her relationship to the sidewalk consisted of the cleared walkway to the door of the museum, the cleared walkway to the door of her apartment building, and the cleared walkway to the revolving door at Bergdorf's. Nora would wear her boots because Bibi was in Palm Beach until Easter.
"I hear it's snowing there,"
Bibi would bellow jubilantly when she called in later in the day, in that way Florida people always did, as though temperate weather alone were equivalent to Lincoln Center, Broadway Theater, endless museums, excellent restaurants, Saks. Although Bibi liked to say that the Saks in Palm Beach was very well curated, which Nora assumed meant it stocked only the really, really pricey things. Nora knew that in a matter of hours she would be sick of the snow, sick of wading through enormous gray puddles of slush at the corners, of tracking the grit the plows laid down into the foyer as Charity rolled her eyes and got out the bucket. But when she first left the house with Homer, she was struck by how beautiful the block looked, the scrawny street trees filled out by their white furry coats. The block was always near the bottom of the street cleaning list, which made perfect sense since it was a dead end, although George vowed every winter to address the issue with their council member, and Jack Fisk insisted he could call a deputy mayor who would move them up the list like that. Fingersnap. Nora assumed that Jack's fingersnapping days were over now, his phone calls unreturned. Jack Fisk? Barely knew him.
"Isn't it lovely?"
Alma called from across the street, as the Fenstermacher poodle, wearing a tartan coat, sniffed at the curb. It occurred often to Nora that they all tended to be much more solicitous of their dogs than of their spouses, and she was not sure whether that was because their dogs loved them unconditionally, did not engage them in conversation, or simply didn't live as long. Sherry Fisk always said monogamy had worked better when people didn't live past 50. It was a huge event on the block when one of the dogs had to be put down. They would always tell one another as successive animals approached 12 or 15, or, in the case of George's loathsome little yappers, 18, because the worst dogs lived longest, that they hoped the dogs would die in their sleep. But that never happened, and after that last trip to the vet, there was always a moment on the block when a neighbor arrived home, dogless. Hugs, murmured condolences. At their age, a parent could die with less ceremony. It was while pausing to let their dogs sniff each other that Linda had asked Nora about Charlie's meeting with a real estate agent. Linda had heard from her husband, Harold, who had heard from George, who else? Nora had not heard about it at all until then.
"I just wanted to get a sense of the market," Charlie said, a bit abashed, but not very. "New York is a younger person's city now."
"We're almost the youngest people on the block," Nora said.
"You know what I mean. All the reasons to live here, they don't make sense for us. How many times have we gone to the theater in the last year? Or a museum?"
"I run a museum.
I mean a real museum," Charlie said. No, you know, one of the major museums. You know what I mean, a big museum."
"You should stop talking," Nora said. It was as though he had seen her weakness and decided to poke her with a sharp stick, and it made her want to poke him back, to tell him she was ready to get Bob's party started. Now, she would never mention what had happened earlier that day, after she had taken the stairs from her office to the third floor, where there was a new exhibit, Turquoise of the Southwest. It wasn't particularly popular, but that wasn't the point. It was one of their habitual attempts to seem serious. Nora had started an education program for children, with a demonstration from their gemologist and a disquisition about gems as an element of geology. She'd instituted a book club with so many women now enrolled that they had had to field three sections. They read a nonfiction account of the Duchess of Windsor's collection, a novel about a diamond cutter in Amsterdam, that kind of thing.
The Seven Sisters crowd, Beebe had said dismissively. The turquoise exhibit was designed for the curators from other museums, the major museums, the big museums, many of whom had opened contempt for the Museum of Jewelry, a contempt that had only grown with the Museum of Jewelry's attendance figures, which had surpassed the American Folk Art Museum and were now closing in on the Frick. Beebe was obsessed with outdoing the Frick, in a way that suggested she might have wanted to join the board there and had been rebuffed. Sometimes on weekends, she would have her driver cruise by what she liked to call her museum on the way to somewhere else, a restaurant downtown, the private airport in New Jersey, and if there was a line of people waiting to get in, she was in a good mood all week long. An exhibit on the silverwork of the Navajos might impress or at least mollify the curators at the more established museums. It was actually a beautiful exhibit. The Museum of the American Indian had loaned them some clay pottery and a few ceremonial robes and headdresses, and the turquoise and silver glowed against a black fabric with a thick nap. But when Nora had gotten up there that afternoon, it was empty except for an old woman with a walker, her long black coat almost dragging on the floor because her curved back and forward lurch had made her inches shorter than she once was. A younger woman in stretch pants, holding a down jacket, was pressed up against an exhibit case across the room. Old woman and paid minder. Like twins, they too were everywhere in New York City. Every time Nora saw a pair together, indivisible like skis and poles or salt and pepper shakers, a small voice in her head said, "Not me." Behind that was another voice that said, "I bet that's what they thought once too." Bang, bang, bang! The old woman was hitting the base of the display case with the walker, with a strength belied by her stringy, spotted hands. Each time she did, the guard yelled, "Ma'am!" and the aide's shoulders jumped. Nora could imagine the aide going home every night, slipping her black lace-up shoes past her bunions, sighing and saying to her husband or her sister or her kids, "That lady is a handful and a half." Nora wondered if even Ricky's wife, Nita, could have kept her under control. She couldn't blame the guard for doing nothing. When Nora moved to the older woman's side, she swiveled with the walker in her hand, and Nora stepped back a bit. "Can I help you?" Nora said quietly. "That's mine," the woman shouted, pointing to the large squash blossom necklace that was the centerpiece of the exhibit. It was not particularly valuable, especially compared to most of what they had, but the center turquoise was very fine and the etchings intricate. "And that," said the woman, gesturing with the walker as the guard moved forward behind her. "That too." A bracelet, another necklace. They were all from Beebe's personal collection, although Nora had never been able to imagine her wearing them. "I can't abide silver," Beebe had told her once. "It's so ordinary. Forks and spoons, okay. Jewelry, forget it."
"They're beautiful pieces," Nora said.
"Oh, good Lord above," said the aide behind her. "They were purchased in Santa Fe," the woman said. "There's a lot of cheap copies for sale out there. These are the real thing."
Her voice sounded like a door that needed its hinges oiled. "Why don't we go to my office? You can tell me more." For the first time, the woman looked up at Nora. The whites of her eyes were a faded yellow, the irises a milky brown, as though if she lived long enough, the colors would meet in the middle. The look in her eyes was knowing, almost predatory, and her first thought, that the woman was senile and confusing jewelry she'd once owned with what they had on exhibit, evaporated.
"You run this place?" the woman said.
"Yes," said Nora, smiling.
"Shame on you,"
the woman said, and she tightened her hands on the bar of the walker, like the little claws of a parakeet on a perch, and clumped out of the exhibition hall, her coat sweeping the floor.
"Thank the Lord," the aide said as they left.
Later, as Nora went over their coming events, a class on gem assessment for men buying an engagement ring, a lecture by a historian on Marie Antoinette's jewels, Richard buzzed her.
"There's a woman here who is asking for a minute or two of your time," he said. "Her name is Deborah Messer. She says her mother was here earlier."
Nora looked down at her computer screen. Richard had texted, "Mother disruptive in Southwest exhibit." Deborah Messer turned out to be a handsome woman,
perhaps 10 years older than Nora. Like her mother, she was a type, albeit a different type, well-dressed in beautifully tailored clothes that might have been in her closet for decades or be brand new, so classic as to be completely unmemorable and acceptable.
"My mother was here today," she said. "I understand she caused quite a kerfuffle."
"There's a word you don't hear very often," Nora said, but the woman didn't smile. "I also understand she may have caused some damage, and I wanted to take care of that."
"There was no damage," Nora said. She was just confused. She seemed to think that some of the pieces in an exhibit of Navajo silver jewelry were hers.
"They are."
"Excuse me?"
"I suppose it's more accurate to say that they were. My mother was Norman Pearl's first wife. I'm his daughter."
If Nora had not spent so many years being politic with older donors and museum trustees, she would have said what she was thinking. Holy shit. Bibi had told her once that most men truly wanted to have three different kinds of wives during their lifetimes. The first one, who was to make a home and a family. The dishy trophy wife, who could be enjoyed and then dispensed with when lust paled and died. And the third wife, who would be devoted but still interesting. Admiring but not slavish. The point was that Bibi was that third wife. Nora didn't know if there had been a second, but it had certainly not occurred to her that Norman Pearl's first wife was even still living.
"I toured the museum soon after it opened," the woman added. "As far as I could tell, none of the things on display belonged to anyone but my father's last wife."
Nora could tell by the way she said this that that was what she always called Bibi, my father's last wife. No Bibi dear from this woman, for sure and certain.
"My father didn't acquire a taste for buying jewelry until after he and my mother divorced. She kept her engagement ring, of course, and a few other things, but there were some items at the weekend house that she'd either forgotten or was forbidden to fetch, depending on whom you believe."
Deborah Messer sighed heavily, as though she was exhaling the poison of years and years.
"I don't know what to say," Nora said. She was painfully aware of the Andy Warhol four-panel portrait above the office sofa, the portrait that Bibi had hung recently to, in her words, dress up the place. The father's last wife, times four, in neon colors.
"There's no need to say anything," Deborah Messer said, standing with her camel hair coat over one arm. "I didn't intend to make you feel bad. I was just concerned about the damages. I'm relieved to know that there weren't any.
Please tell your mother that I'm sorry."
"For what?" "She was the first wife of a rich man who got much richer after the divorce. It's not an unusual story. She has everything she needs. I don't know how she found out about these things, but I imagine they were just symbolic." She chuckled mirthlessly.
"His whole place is symbolic, isn't it?" she said, and for a moment the mask fell.
It happened so seldom in Nora's world that it was even more shocking than what had gone before. In an instant, the placid water of good manners closed over the fury and erased it as though it had never been. But the mother's words had seemed reflected in the daughter's face. "Shame on you." "A real museum," Charlie said to her that night. There couldn't have been a worse night for him to say that. There hadn't been a time when Nora had felt so uncertain of what she was doing. "Shame on you," she heard over and over again. "Shame on you." And she knew if she told Bibi, the big boss, what had happened, she would say contemptuously, "Oh, them, those two, the detritus of the past with their silver jewelry and wool coats."
"All those emeralds getting you down?"
Phil had said when she passed him at the end of the day, and when she went on without a look or greeting, she heard him say quietly to himself,
"One of those days."
But she shared none of that with her husband. There had been times when she and Charlie had aired their uncertainties with each other, but not this time. Instead, she narrowed her eyes and said, "Let me give you the bottom line, Charlie. I am staying in my little job, in my little museum, living in my little house. I am not selling it, and since my name is on the deed, you can't sell either. It's as simple as that. End of discussion."
"Bun,"
Charlie began, but Nora interrupted. "I've had a really long day. I'm going to bed." The lot is closed to all parking until further notice. Fees will be reimbursed at the end of the month on a pro rata basis.
Any car found in the lot will be towed. Sydney Stoller. New York hospitals were like telephone companies. They had started out smallish and local, and then merged and merged and merged so that they became behemoths. The greatest behemoth of all was the hospital in which Nora had given birth to the twins. From the bridge, it looked like a small city, and inside it felt like one. Charlie had gotten lost in its hallways when Nora was recovering from her C-section, and had somehow found himself entering neuro-oncology, which he'd only realized after he passed two rooms in which the occupants had shaved heads with railroad tracks of staples across them. It had taken directions from two nurses and an orderly to get him back to maternity. It also turned out to be the hospital where Ricky was recovering from yet another surgery, which Nora had learned through various disapproving miming gestures from Charity. Nora was ashamed that she hadn't visited sooner. She stood paralyzed in the gift shop. Flowers, balloons, a teddy bear whose shirt said, "Hope you're bearing up." She settled on a large box of chocolates. She figured that even if Ricky didn't have a sweet tooth, his children must. 802B, she said in one of the endless hallways, and someone hurrying in the other direction pointed. It was a double room, but one bed was obviously unoccupied. Ricky was in the other, his leg encased in a cast to the hip. Immobilized by equipment that looked not unlike one of the trusses on the bridge seen from the window of the hospital room. In the buzzing fluorescence of the terrible overhead lighting, he looked waxy and slightly gray. She remembered that the doctors had wanted to keep Rachel for a few additional days after Nora had given birth, because they said the baby had jaundice. "In this light, how can you tell?" Nora said to the doctors. "Everybody looks jaundiced. You look jaundiced." They said it was clear in the blood tests, but she'd taken Rachel home anyhow, even though she had looked a little yellower than Oliver. Ricky's breathing was shallow, but he seemed to be sleeping soundly. A breakfast tray still held a plastic cup of that kind of orange juice that separated into watery top and bright, unappetizing bottom. "Like sunset in a toxic nuclear sky," Ollie had said once when he was holding a glass of the stuff in a dining hall during a college visit. "That's a little dramatic," Nora had said, but she'd never forgotten the turn of phrase. Nora remembered that when Charlie had gotten lost in the hospital, she was furious because she was so hungry, and he had promised her a pastrami sandwich and chocolate pudding. When he finally arrived at her room, where a lactation consultant had just tried to explain how to breastfeed twins, in succession, which had almost killed her over the months that she'd done it, Nora was in a fine postpartum rage state until Charlie opened a greasy white paper bag and took out a glazed donut. It was one of those just-made donuts that tasted like a cloud composed of sugar and fat. Nora had bitten into it and started to cry.
"I can't believe you brought me this," she said around an enormous mouthful.
"I got the sandwich and the pudding, too," Charlie said.
"No. No, this is perfect. It's so good. It might be the single best thing I've ever eaten in my entire life."
"Your hormones are out of control," Charlie said, unwrapping the sandwich on her tray table.
"I love you,"
Nora mumbled, stuffing the rest of the donut into her mouth.
"I love you too."
Looking at Ricky's breakfast tray, she could almost taste that donut. Someone had told her that elsewhere in the hospital there were rooms with toile drapes, nice art, a menu from which you could choose your dinner. But she was quite sure Ricky's insurance wouldn't cover that. She had once thought hospitals were the great equalizers, but in New York, even they could be stratified, so that people with money seemed to be in a completely different place from people with none, or even people with less. She had once complained about how long it had taken in the ER when Ollie had cut the underside of his chin open on the edge of the tub. Another mother at school had said, "You took him to the ER? My pediatrician says to dose them with codeine and wait until morning to take them to a good plastic surgeon." Now that Oliver was a head taller than she was, Nora sometimes saw the small pink line where he'd gotten 5 stitches and wondered if she should have waited until morning and taken him to a good plastic surgeon. In Manhattan, finding one must be like finding a good latte. Just walk down the street with your wallet out. She put the box of chocolates next to the breakfast tray and stood silently, looking at Ricky's face. He had a couple days' growth of beard, the way male models and movie actors did nowadays. She supposed shaving was beside the point. On one arm, he had an IV line attached to one of those little boxes that she knew from visiting Jean Anne after she had had her mastectomy, allowed you to dose yourself with morphine. She was just starting to wonder whether she should leave when Ricky opened his eyes. It seemed to take him a minute to focus them.
I didn't mean to wake you, Nora whispered.
No. No, that's okay. Sit down. It's nice that you came. Charity said you might come by.
Nora pulled up a chair. Are you in a lot of pain? She said.
It's not so bad now. In the beginning,
Ricky grimaced. I'm so sorry, Enrique.
Nothing to do with you, Mrs. Nolan, he said. How's Mr. Nolan?
Nora wondered if Ricky knew that Charlie was parroting the Jack line to the authorities. Nora had shifted to saying, talk to your father, when the twins asked about it.
Good. He was asking about you. He wanted you to know he's sorry, too.
Not true, but suitable.
Everyone on the block really misses you.
Absolutely true. The forecast was for a freak ice storm later in the week, and Nora knew that everyone was wondering who would salt the sidewalks, as though salting the sidewalks were a complex ritual that none of them could manage themselves, since it involved a bag of salt and the ability to drop it in handfuls.
How's the dryer vent?
The dryer vent?
Charity, she's not getting the clothes dry the way she used to. The last time that happened, I cleaned out the vent with a shop vac. A lot of people think you can take care of the lint filter, you got it covered, but a lot of lint winds up in that dryer vent, and then it doesn't dry so well.
Ricky smiled, his eyelids at half-mast. Nora wondered whether he was high from the medication, and also whether, when they lived in the apartment, they'd gotten rid of a perfectly fine dryer that seemed as though it didn't work anymore, purely because they hadn't used a shop vac on the vent.
She hasn't said anything to me. Maybe it's better. Or maybe she's just waiting for you to come back and fix it for her. You know the way Charity is. She doesn't like change much.
Maybe I can get one of the other guys to go down. I gotta see how they feel about that, you know? Plus, how they could get down there. You know, there are a lot of issues.
Ricky looked away, grimaced again. Oh, I almost forgot, Nora said, reaching into her purse and pulling out an envelope. Your Christmas bonus. I never got to give it to you. She laid the envelope on the tray table next to the chocolates. I didn't want to wait until you were back to work.
Ah, you didn't have to do that. But I appreciate it. It's tough, you know. I missed the job. Charity comes by, she tells me about something like the dryer vent. I feel bad. She's got to have a dryer that works, Charity. You don't want her to have problems with that machine.
What the hell?
Said a loud voice from the doorway. A small, round woman in acid-washed jeans and a T-shirt stood there, and Nora realized that until now, she'd seen Ricky's wife only from the chest up and at a distance.
Hi, Nita, Nora said. I just wanted to see how your husband was doing. I brought some chocolates.
What the hell? You talking to him about fixing your damn dryer, the shape he's in? Look at him! The man might never walk again, and all you care about is your damn dryer?
Babe, it's Mrs. Nolan. She's the one who brought the humidifier up that time. She sent all the boys all that stuff, the soccer goal, the checker game. She's got Charity works for her. They got a problem.
They got zero problems, Rico. You're the one with the problems. Your leg all busted up like that. You brought chocolates? You bring his van back fixed up? You bring the money he'd be making if he wasn't lying here in a hospital bed? You bring my rent money?
A nurse stuck her head in. You're disturbing the other patients again, Mrs. Ramos, she said. I should leave. Nora said. I should let you rest, Enrique. Nita stood in her way, with her arms across her chest. Her cleavage was still gargantuan. Nora noticed that she had a deep, ropey scar along one cheek, as though someone who hadn't really learned how to suture skin had practiced on her a long time ago. She was wearing a gold cross, a St. Christopher medal, and a nameplate necklace that said Juanita. She followed Nora out into the hallway, which was bright with even less flattering fluorescent lights and pale green paint. All hospital corridors could double as operating theaters in a pinch.
I just wanted to see how he was doing, Nora said.
Maybe take it back into the room, the nurse at the nurse's station said. Nita ignored the nurse, who looked nervous.
You people, Nita said. You make me laugh. How's he doing? His leg bone is broken in two places. He's got pins in it. 20 stitches in his leg, and that's before they cut him open for the pins. A couple of torn ligaments that the doctors say might really be a problem in the future. In the future, they say, he could have some problems bending the knee. It's gonna be hard for him to fix your dryer then, huh?
She started out in almost a normal tone of voice, but now she was yelling. The nurse stood up. Obviously, the staff was familiar with Nita. I'm so sorry about what happened.
Yeah, you're all sorry. What about the son of a bitch who did this? He sorry? He gonna pay? Rehab? Lost wages? Pain and suffering? Compensation?
She sounded like the personal injury lawyers who advertised on TV. Nora wondered if she'd already hired one. I hope your boys are okay, she said.
How you think they are? You want to explain to them why some crazy person beat their father up so bad he put him in the hospital?
Put that way, it sounded as though Nora had wound up on the wrong side of some battle line. She said, all of us on the block like Enrique and miss him. Nita pushed past her, and though the hallway was wide, she came much too close, elbowing Nora aside. Nora felt stupid for coming in the first place.
How many more worthless assholes from where you live coming here to pretend they care whether he lives or dies?
Nita said over her shoulder. He seems like a nice man, said the nurse behind Nora at the nurse's station in a low voice. She's a piece of work, though. Nora took the subway back downtown afterward. She remembered taking it up there when she was pregnant, to visit her doctor, to tour the hospital. It had been terrifying. It wasn't just that she was so big that she felt she might pitch forward off of the platform onto the tracks. The subway was scarier then. The twins and their friends rode it now at all hours. Every once in a while you get a weenie wagger, but if you pull out your phone to take a picture, they usually stop, one of Rachel's friends had said. The train was the great equalizer now, not the hospitals, not the neighborhoods, the way they'd been when she first came to the city. The Upper West Side had had students and old people, Puerto Ricans and Orthodox Jews, strollers and shopping carts filled with the ersatz acquisitions of people who lived on the streets. Now it had black cars waiting for corporate pickups at the curbs, and expensive mountain bikes in the park. No one tried to steal car radios nowadays, and no one feared having the bike stolen. Nora supposed this was an improvement. She was packed tightly into a subway car with medical students still wearing their scrubs, hipsters in short, tight pants, a few of what looked like Columbia professors carrying leather book bags, brown girls, black guys, a man who said he was collecting for the homeless and looked homeless himself and played a harmonica. It was like a casting director had said to herself, something for everyone, like a diorama of New York City life. A teenage girl with cornrows and a City College sweatshirt offered Nora a seat, and she shook her head and felt old because of the gesture and stupid for going to the hospital in the first place. As she came down her block, she saw a young man pick up a black trash bag from in front of the Fisk's house and hoist it over his shoulder. Reporters go through people's trash now? She said, enraged, while the man blinked behind his glasses. Is that what journalism has come to? Do you people have no shame?
This is my laundry, he said quietly.
What?
My laundry. I'm taking my clothes to the laundromat.
That's what renters did. Laundry and trash bags, boxes of empties after parties. Whatever, Nora said as he looked at her quizzically. It was the rudest she could remember being in years. Nita had undone her. How pleased she would be to know that.
Are you nuts? Said Charlie that night when she told him about the hospital visit. Those people are going to sue the Fisks, and you went up there to see how they're doing?
While Charlie's face was normally ruddy, it had turned practically purple. He's a person who worked in our home, Nora said. He's a good person, and I like him. Jack is a bad person, and I don't like him. So yes, I went up there to see how he's doing. And by the way, he's not doing very well. That leg is a mess, which is what I suppose happens to your leg when someone keeps hitting it with a golf club.
Nora, Ricky is a person who did odd jobs for us. He's not our friend. He's a neighborhood handyman. Jack is our friend.
Jack's not my friend. I think he's a terrible person, and he deserves whatever he gets.
What are you thinking? Are you trying to take sides against our neighbors?
Aren't you interested in doing the right thing, Charlie? You talk all the time about Jack's versions of events. Aren't you interested in the truth? What about the truth?
Ugh, Jesus, Nora. You're on such a high horse with this. I don't know how you'll ever get off. Just don't drag me into whatever crazy liberal guilt thing you've got going on.
I don't have a crazy liberal guilt thing going on, Nora said. I have a human thing going on. Sherry Fisk was annoyed, too. Nora felt sorrier about Sherry's reaction than Charlie's, but not sorry enough to regret what she'd done.
I just wish you'd mentioned it to us, Nora, Sherry said when she ran into her on the block. Apparently, Ricky's wife told their attorney that you said Jack was to blame for what happened.
I absolutely did not say that or anything like that.
She says you told her that you were sorry for what Jack did.
I said I was sorry. I never mentioned Jack's name or the particulars of what happened.
She also said you gave them money.
I gave him a Christmas card with his Christmas bonus in it, Sherry. That's all. He shouldn't have to lose his Christmas bonus.
Well, Sherry said, sighing, it's just unfortunate. We're in the middle of trying to work something out with them so that this whole thing can be nipped in the bud. The timing of your visit wasn't great in terms of those negotiations.
I'm sorry if I upset you, Nora said. His wife talked as though I wasn't the only one who had visited.
Yes, Sherry Fisk said. George went up there and apparently told Ricky that if he didn't say the whole thing was an accident, he would never work on the block again. That wasn't helpful either.
Nora felt her face grow hot. Being lumped in with George was a terrible feeling. Apparently, Ricky's wife came in and hit George with a crutch. It's the only good thing to come out of this whole sorry situation. Sherry started to laugh a little tentatively, as though she hadn't laughed in a while, and was trying to get the laugh motor running again.
I have to admit, the idea of someone hitting George with a crutch made my day.
She didn't hit you, did she?
Nora shook her head, although she suspected Nita had wanted to.
As Nora was going toward the double doors that led to the elevators, walking fast, although what she really wanted to do was sprint, she had heard footfalls behind her.
Hey!
Nita called, and Nora turned to see her with the candy box in her hand.
You leave this?
The food is pretty terrible here, right?
Not bad enough to eat these,
she said, shoving the box hard into Nora's chest.
And all that stuff you give Rico for the kids? He sells it all on eBay. Ice skates? Who you kidding, lady? Ice skates?
Nora and Charlie were a little surprised to find themselves going to a dinner party, but it saved them eating alone together, which had become difficult since they were barely speaking, and it was an invitation that could not be denied. Charlie still had hopes of another rung on the ladder at Parsons Ridge, and the dinner was being given by one of the so-called rainmakers, Jim DeGeneres. There had almost been a snafu. Charlie had looked at the date and time, but not the address, and until the afternoon of the dinner, had planned to meet Nora at the DeGeneres apartment, a rather bare but enormous place with elaborate moldings and fireplaces off Fifth. But his assistant had reminded him that Jim and his wife were now separated, and that Jim had moved to a loft in Tribeca, neither of which Charlie had known, making it even more important that they attend the dinner party.
A Tribeca loft, said Nora, where rich guys go when they ditch the first wife. When he remarries someone younger, he'll move to Madison Park.
Maybe table the cynicism for tonight, Charlie said on the phone. This could be important for me.
Nora had lost count of how many times her husband had said this. They each found the other's work inconsequential, for very different reasons, but hers was shinier in public. Charlie was interested in what she did when he could proffer it for possible professional gain, or at least reflected stature. He needed the card to play. He was afraid that he was never going to be one of the big men, the ones whose names popped up in Forbes or the Journal. He was usually the third guy to be introduced to the major client in the conference room.
Is Jim cooking? Nora asked.
I have no idea, Charlie said.
Charlie had never cooked a thing in his life. When she left him something to reheat, on those evenings she was out with a prospect or a friend, he would always text, "What temp? How long?" Several years before, she had written on the chalkboard in the kitchen, 3:50, 30 minutes. It was still there. She'd once seen a quote on someone's inspiration board. Kill me if I ever have an inspiration board,
she'd said to her sister, who'd responded with a silence so weighty that Nora instantly concluded that Christine had one, that said, insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. She actually sometimes thought that was the definition of marriage. Everyone attributes that quote to Einstein, said Jenny, standing in the wreckage of what had been her old kitchen and would become her new one. It's not Einstein. Maybe it was Einstein's wife. Was Einstein married? Jenny had nodded. Can you imagine? You're not married to a man who thinks he's Einstein. You're married to a man who is Einstein. God, this looks great, Nora said, when Jenny showed her the cabinet door samples. This finish is beautiful. Jasper really knows what he's doing, although I assume you get special treatment. That's what happens when you're filleting the craftsman, Jenny said. Oh my God, Jen, Nora said. I love that you're still shockable. Seriously, he's really talented, and I don't just mean in the obvious way. He reads all the time. He cooks, too. Oh, please, save me from the man who allegedly cooks. This is completely different, Nora. He's not a guy who talks about cooking or buys a $10,000 stove and then tells you you can't make osobuco properly on anything else. He's a guy who goes through the cupboards, stops at the butcher, and makes real food that tastes good without making a big deal about it or expecting you to act like he cured cancer. Jim DeGeneres was the other guy, the guy who acted as though making a meal were akin to nuclear fission, who produced food that tasted of nothing or too much of something you couldn't identify and didn't particularly like. Nora knew this new place would have a monumental kitchen, and it did. The Tribeca loft was cavernous and modern, but oddly, done in Swedish antiques, all white and blue. It was the kind of downtown place that, for a few years after September 11, would have gone begging. Everyone who lived below Canal Street had been traumatized. Everyone who had considered buying or renting there had gone elsewhere. But though everyone was fond of saying that New York and New Yorkers had been changed forever by the terrorist attacks, forever in terms of real estate lasted about 30 months. A shiny new tower stood where the Twin Towers had crumpled to the earth, and the downtown real estate market had bounced back. At some point, Nora expected Jim to say, "I don't want to tell you what I paid for this place," and then proceeded to do just that. "Nora," Jim said, "you cut your hair." Not a good beginning. Over the years, Nora had learned that when a man said you'd cut your hair, it was less an observation than an indictment. She decided to parry with a generalization, since she had in fact been wearing her hair the same way for a decade. "It's been too long, Jim. I hope you're cooking."
"Of course," he said.
Thank God for big lunches.
"You haven't changed a bit."
Why do they all say that to each other? There was the fact that it was so patently untrue. Nora had looked at herself in the bathroom mirror as she was applying mascara and realized that her skin had begun to look like silk after you washed it, still serviceable, but without its sheen. She had never been vain and had never felt she had reason to be. Strangers were always asking her whether they knew her from high school or the ad agency or this or that suburb, because she looked like a generic woman of a certain age. Even the people she knew who had taken preemptive action to maintain their looks had changed more than a bit. And that was only the exterior.
"I used to really like him, but Jim's a different guy now," Charlie had said on their way downtown.
As was Charlie, of course, and Nora as well.
"How's the jewelry business?"
Jim said.
"You're in the jewelry business?"
said a thin blonde behind him. "Not really," said Nora.
"I want to hear all about what happened on that block of yours," Jim said. "What a story. Everyone's been talking about it."
And Nora suddenly realized exactly why they had been invited. Luckily, Charlie was placing a drink order with the cater waiter and hadn't heard.
"Charlie, come, sous chef,"
Jim cried. Charlie shucked his jacket, took off his tie, and rolled up his sleeves so that he was dressed like Jim. Nora was dressed in her dinner party uniform. Black dress, statement necklace.
"Are those real?"
said the blonde, peering at the stones. "If they were, I'd need an armed guard," Nora said. But the blonde continued to peer and didn't crack a smile. There were two other men there, one above Charlie in the pecking order, another young but, from the sound of him, promising, with a kind of party patter that was smooth and memorable, a few witticisms, a recommendation for a New Yorker article, the kind of bright young man her husband would have once befriended and now hated and feared. His wife was a lawyer, semi-retired, who had just had her second child and wanted to talk only about private school admissions. Nora was tolerant. She had passed through a phase in which she did the same, until the twins had been accepted to a school that had been founded just after the American Revolution and that, most important, ran from kindergarten to the end of high school. The semi-retired lawyer's eyes lit up when Nora mentioned it. Jennifer? Jessica? The husband's name was Jason. She was certain of that. It was so hard to remember. Nora's assistants had always been told to give her flashcards to tuck beneath the napkin in her lap when she was hosting a donor lunch so that she could keep the name straight.
Charlie, when's the last time you diced an onion?
She heard Jim say in that kidding way that had an edge of exasperation. Mumble, mumble. Charlie was probably saying he didn't cook as much as he used to. Nora glided away from the kitchen, an open-plan stainless steel number that looked as though it had been lifted right from one of those restaurants whose layout demanded you admire the chef's technique. Since Nora had first moved to New York, dinner parties had mainly evaporated. In the beginning, there had been one a week, exercises in competitive cooking. "Whose is this?" they would ask one another, the way they now asked it about a particularly sharp coat or pair of boots. Marcella, Julia. Cookbook intimacy that passed for friendship. At the end of every evening, they were wrecked by the need for perfection and the assumption of judgment. Then they'd made some money and graduated to virtual cooking. Nora discovered that, like manicures and pedicures, cooking was something she could do herself but preferred to have someone else do for her. She was one of the first to discover Homemade, a company that delivered meals with little cards that described how to prepare them. Like dress designers supplying gowns for a big gala. The women who ran the company kept a computerized accounting of who'd ordered what to avoid unfortunate duplications. When Nora sent along a list of guests, one of them might say, "If you're having the Roysters, don't get the chicken Marengo. They served it themselves last week." It all seemed like cheating, but Nora prided herself on the fact that at least she didn't lie and pretend the homemade dinners were homemade. In the beginning, lots of other women did, but after a while it became impossible. The roster was so well known, although Sherry Fisk's sister-in-law swore her apple brown Betty was her grandmother's recipe when it was exactly the same dessert in the same ramekins that they'd all had elsewhere. "She claims her nose is original, too," Sherry had once said. Eventually, they had all started meeting at restaurants so that no one had to hide the pill vials in the medicine cabinets from nosy guests. It seemed the only time they went to dinner parties now was when the men had taken up cooking. Everyone acted as though they were akin to Christ turning water into wine at Cana. "Risotto!" the women exclaimed joyfully when Jim brought it to the table in an enormous, shallow serving bowl, which Nora knew meant by the time it got to her, it would be lukewarm, which was fine. It was crunchy, too, which meant she wouldn't eat much.
"You need to work on your husband's knife skills," Jim said, pointing his fork at her.
Knife skills. This was a new badge of honor, a status symbol for guys who had finally, finally, become tired of talking about wine. The slightly aberrational spouse was a status symbol, too. The husband who cooked, the wife who played golf, the husband who took his children to school, the wife who ran her own business. Of course, it was chancier with the women than with the men. You couldn't push it too far. The marathoner wife who made partner, perhaps. The wife who could bench press her own weight and made the cover of Fortune, too emasculating. The men, on the other hand, got unlimited mileage out of performing so-called women's tasks as long as they also had substantial disposable income and significant business cards. Occasionally, a woman would say of her husband, "He's a stay-at-home dad," and everyone would smile and think, "He doesn't have a job." Jim's wife had been a significant woman. A doctor who treated people with addiction issues, which probably explained why he was a wine aficionado. Nora could hear Polly now saying to her husband, "Nora might have better things to do than work on a husband's knife skills." Charlie and Nora had been close friends with Jim and Polly once upon a time. They had lived in similar three-bedroom apartments,
not far from each other, and had children around the same age. There had been a couple of years there when one Sunday a month they had had takeout dinners in each other's places, the children throwing Lego blocks around in the next room while the grown-ups ate Peking duck or sashimi. Jim and Polly had nothing that Charlie and Nora wanted except for a wood-burning fireplace, which Polly said was more trouble than it was worth. "We have to start a fire hours before anyone arrives because the room fills with smoke," she said. "Can you smell it?" By the look on Jim's face when she said this, Nora could tell it was one of those low-level arguments that married couples had frequently.
"What good is a wood-burning fireplace if you don't have a fire?" Jim said.
Nora had enjoyed those evenings. The men would talk across the table to each other about work, and the women about their children. Then someone had canceled, and someone else had canceled, and Jim had become a bigger deal than Charlie, which Nora only figured out at the cocktail party Jim and Polly had had as a housewarming for their new place, which no amount of partying could warm, with its marble entrance foyer and elaborate window treatments. She and Polly agreed, when the Nolans were leaving the party, Charlie impatiently holding the elevator, that they would schedule lunch. They would. And then they never did. And now Nora never could. Having lunch with the estranged wife of a man your husband wanted to think well of him was a no-go. Charlie had never liked Polly. He had always said he thought she was difficult, also not sexy. He was seated now with the thin blonde on one side. Allison? Melissa? The conversation was a hubbub, like modern music, discordant with odd bleats and no melody. People in New York never really listened to anyone else. They just waited for a break in the action so they could start to speak, push off with their own boat into the slipstream of talk. "Your wife is in the jewelry business?" Nora heard the blonde ask Charlie.
"How large is your endowment?" said young Jason,
who obviously knew precisely what Nora did. The kind of man who researched his fellow guests before a dinner party. "Substantial for the size of a museum," she said. "Plus, we own the building free and clear, which is certainly an advantage."
"And your annual budget?"
Nora tapped the table with her dessert fork and laughed. "Are you really interested?"
"I'm interested in board service. I'm trying to decide where."
"That's interesting. People are usually much cagier about that than you are."
"Should I be cagier?"
She laughed again and saw Charlie narrow his eyes across the table. She realized she had to hit some sweet spot between being nice to Jason and appearing to be too cozy with him. "I'll be candid with you," she said. "Our board is largely decorative. The founder of the museum picks its members for optimal society traction. She makes all the decisions herself."
"I'll be candid right back," Jason said. "I'd be interested in being involved with Bob Harris's foundation."
"I don't know anything about that," Nora said.
"Really? Because he talks as though he's certain you'll be running it."
"Running what?" Charlie said from across the table. Luckily, dessert was served, lemon tart and raspberries, and Jim tapped her arm, so she turned from Jason.
"I want to hear all about this crazy thing on your block," he said. "I don't know Jack Fisk, but I know lots of people who do, and they say he must have lost his mind. I told them, well, I know someone who will be able to give me all the details."
Later, as she pulled her nightgown over her head, Nora said to Charlie, "Did Jim ask you about Jack Fisk?"
"It's all he wanted to talk about," Charlie said sourly. "It's the same deal in the office. Someone comes in and I think they want me for a meeting or on a call, and instead it's all, what the hell happened there? Plus, they all think it was a tire iron. Why the hell would Jack swing a tire iron?"
"A golf club makes more sense."
"And what about you and Jason?"
her husband said, as though she hadn't spoken.
"There's a guy who's an operator. His middle initial is H. I think it stands for Howard, but we all say it really stands for hungry. He's one of those guys you're afraid to turn your back on. He's sort of Jim's boy, which is why he was there. I guess he knows something I don't know about you and Harris."
"Oh, for God's sake, Charlie. He's just ambitious, like everyone else in town. He doesn't know anything, and Jim needs to learn how to make risotto. It was like chewing gravel. And how could he trade Polly in for whoever she was?"
"He didn't," Charlie said in the darkness as she got under the covers. "One of the other guys in the office told me this morning. Polly left him. She was apparently having an affair with some other doctor for years, and Once their youngest kid was out of the house, she figured, what's the point? I hear he's really a mess.
He didn't act like he was a mess.
Yeah, like he's gonna fall apart with the people at that table? He got wasted at some cigar bar last week and told one of the guys that he has sex with that girl all the time because when they're not having sex, she talks to him and he can't stand to listen to her.
He'll find somebody else, Nora said. He's rich. He's nice looking. Maybe he'll even learn to cook.
What do you want to bet Jason knows how to cook? Said Charlie.
He probably studied at the Cordon Bleu after his Rhodes Scholarship.
A petition is being prepared to request that the lot be reopened at the same rate as previously. Please let George know if you are willing to sign.
The lot is closed to all activity until further notice. Any cars in the lot will be towed at the owner's expense. Sydney Stoller. The empty lot was a constant reminder. That and the fact that nothing worked in any of their houses. A dripping tap in the Nolan kitchen kept on dripping. Harold Lessman tripped over a flagstone in the patio that had heaved up during the winter freezes and spring thaws and sprained his ankle. The Fisks were mainly at their house in the country, but their housekeeper, Grace, told Charity that there was a leak in the skylight and she had to put a bucket in the hall. Ricky had made himself essential. They had all made themselves helpless.
I hear you know the golf club guy,
Phil said, sitting outside the museum with a new sign that said, still crazy after all these years.
Don't you think that one will put people off? Nora said, pointing at the cardboard placard.
You know, people our age love this one. I'm thinking of using nothing but song titles from now on. Maybe Born in the USA. When does the big boss come back from Florida?
You really keep up on things, Nora said.
I'm a student of my surroundings, he said. Who's your new guy? The skinny one.
He's a temp, Nora said. My assistant quit.
The snooty tall one? I can't believe you put up with her for a minute. She never said hello to me. Not once. This new guy is a good guy. Smart, too. You think you'll keep him?
I'm thinking about it, Nora said. Richard was still technically working for the temp agency, but Nora had made it a point to sit down and talk to him after he had rearranged her computer files so that finding anything made infinitely more sense.
My parents came here from the Philippines, he had said. Seven kids, and here's all they want, a college degree and then a job where you don't get your hands dirty. All they know is that right now I work in a museum. No dirt, right?
A museum, but not jewelry? Nora asked.
I'm not sure they'd get it, Richard said. I'm not sure that I get it, to be honest, but I like working for you. Where did your last assistant go, if you don't mind my asking?
The Met, of course, the pinnacle of New York museums. Madison had sent Nora a note on stationery engraved with her initials. I learned so much from you, she wrote, a student of the No Bridges Burned playbook. Apparently, she had told Bibi's assistant that she didn't think there was sufficient room for growth for her, that the museum was a one-woman show. The woman she meant was not Nora.
There's a man on the phone for you,
Richard said as Nora took off her coat.
He won't give his name, but he said to tell you.
He looked down at his notepad.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy ride.
A bumpy night, Nora said. It's going to be a bumpy night. It's a line from a movie. All about Eve. Everyone gets it wrong.
I thought he said ride.
No, he didn't. James, she said into the phone in her office.
Money Penny, he replied.
That's what he'd always called her. James Mortimer. Ever since they'd ripped through three James Bond movies the month they first met. She was Money Penny, and he was James. Never Jimmy or Jim, or God forbid, as he had once said early on at a crowded party full of lacrosse players, Jimbo.
You're blessed, he said then. No one can turn Nora into anything else.
My sister calls me Nani, she said.
That's different,
he said.
My sister calls me Manchild. Manny, for short.
His sister lived in London, his parents in the suburbs of Philadelphia, or that's what he called them, which sounded fine until he and Nora had started up the long driveway on a snaky street where none of the houses were visible from the sidewalk. Nora was too young to know then what she knew now, that on the outskirts of every American city, there were areas in which the houses were invisible from the road, and that that was where the richest people lived. Grosse Pointe, Bel Air, Buckhead.
During her years raising money for museums and schools, she'd been to almost all of them. The Mortimers lived in Gladwin. They were stereotypical bad parents, almost stock characters from a